Welcome to Indie Worldwide. I'm your host, Anthony.
Thank you.
We have with us today Philip Thomas, the founder of Moonlight, the founder of Staffjoy, a former Y Combinator fellow, VP engineering at Zyper. Currently looks like you're advising a new startup. Busy man. You've gotten a lot done so far in your career. Do you want to give a short like self-introduction? Tell us a bit about like where you started and what you're up to now.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Ohio, went to school in Missouri, thinking I was going to get into like the medicine or science areas. And while doing research in a lab, I realized I really liked coding way more than like biology, and started building products after that. And ended up moving out to Silicon Valley after graduating to work as a software engineer. My first job there was at a company called OpenDNS, which ended up getting acquired by Cisco after a few years. After that, I kind of combined what I was learning in college with my love of building products and started a workforce management startup called Staffjoy that was servicing app-based delivery models. Everything from app-based laundry to app-based packages to app-based cookies at that time. And then after that company didn't do super well, I left San Francisco, started traveling full-time for a few years, and co-founded a company called Moonlight to help software developers find remote work. We were really focused on contract to hire, so the site was a mix of contract and full-time work. We bootstrapped that for a couple of years to ramen profitability, and then raised a small round of venture capital, and then ended up selling that company earlier this year to another company called Pull Request that operates in the developer marketplace area also, but they're really focused on helping companies get quality code review, which was really complementary to the Moonlight product. So Moonlight continues to operate today at moonlightwork.com. After that, I went and worked a little bit with a startup, but they were not really in a position to grow and use my resources yet. So I'm kind of between gigs right now, starting something new in a few weeks. But, you know, right now I'm kind of in a mini sabbatical for a month and reading and hanging out, which has been a lot of fun. Probably the first time I've taken more than a week off in, I don't know, since high school. I'm not sure.
That's been a while. You got to take a vacation sometimes, yeah, just for the sake of your brain capacity. I think it's easy to overwork yourself, and then you'll just eventually run out of creative juice, I think, if you don't give yourself a second to breathe. Maybe that's just definitely me. Some people can go 24/7.
I did take vacations and breaks, but I haven't had over a week of unstructured time in a long time, so it's been fun.
So let's dig in a bit to Moonlight, because I feel like that is the most follows like the bootstrapper's dream, I guess, of starting from zero, growing it. Eventually you raise money once you've already got some traction. Can you tell me a bit about where the idea of Moonlight came from and what it looked like in its earliest days?
Yeah. So Moonlight was a two-sided market. So we had developers who were looking for work and companies who were looking to hire. And so I experienced the problem on both sides of the market. So with Staffjoy, we had raised millions of dollars in venture funding and had just a horrible time hiring. And I got really inspired by hiring really high quality contractors, like friends who had day jobs or were freelancing for a bit between jobs. And it really made it easier to work with great people, work with specialists that we couldn't necessarily bring on full time, like someone who specialized in Kubernetes. And, you know, we didn't need a full-time Kubernetes person for more than a couple of weeks. And so that ability to hire people flexibly, work with them remotely, and be able to build rapport with them instead of like going through this extended like rigmarole of a hiring process of screening calls and whiteboard interviews was really nice, and worked for us. And so that's kind of one side of the Moonlight inspiration. And then the other side was leaving San Francisco and starting to work remotely from Mexico City first. We freelanced to begin Moonlight and kind of tapered off freelancing over time. So we were never like dipping that deep into like savings, because we were kind of self-funding it while freelancing. And so on that side, we were the first developers on Moonlight also. So we really appreciated that it's hard to get access to high quality work remotely. And we had started this company in 2017. So I know right now in COVID, the idea of companies hiring remotely makes a lot of sense. But prior to COVID, it was less mainstream. And we really saw contract to hire as a way to get a lot of companies that were resistant to full-time remote workforces to hire remotely. And so we had our own connections from having lived in Silicon Valley for years, but you know, friends who were not connected to the network as deeply had trouble getting access to high quality work. And we always heard people on one side saying, I just need more great software engineers. And then on the other side, people saying, like, I am a really great software engineer, but no one wants to hire me if I'm not based in the Bay Area. And so we started Moonlight to connect those two sides.
I'm noticing, I'm feeling a lot of parallels between your story, Moonlight, my story, Indie Worldwide, and also the connection of like Moonlight itself. Left San Francisco a couple years ago, after living there for a year, started freelancing, started meetup groups, eventually starting like this Indie Worldwide group because it was hard to like meet people remotely. And like one of many services I signed up looking for freelance work was Moonlight, which is how you got on my radar in the first place.
Oh, wow.
I
didn't know that.
I think I've been on the Moonlight platform for over a year, maybe 2 years.
Oh, that's cool.
As I was looking for people to bring on, I was like, you know who would be awesome to have on? Is whoever started Moonlight. I bet they have a cool story.
That's great.
And that's how I found you.
How was your Moonlight experience?
So I've mostly just been kind of a lurker on Moonlight, like taking in the like email blasts and stuff. My philosophy with like freelancing is less is more, and I try to take fewer, better gigs. So I like to have many channels of inbound so that I can pick and choose a few gigs a year that I really like and are really like profitable to take on and still leave me time to work on the other 1,000 projects that I want to work on.
I had a friend last night tell me something I'd never heard before that I thought was really brilliant, which was, when you're looking for freelance work, you want to look for clients that are constrained on time rather than constrained on money. Because people that are constrained on money are just trying to get a deal, but people that are constrained on time are much more open to working with really high skill people and, you know, giving them the reins. And I think that's what I've seen as a pattern among like the best freelance clients is always the ones who are time constrained.
Yeah, you really feel the difference. It's like, whatever number you say, great, let's do it. Can you get it done by next week? Versus, let's talk about it for weeks before we even come to a number. And you definitely want the former, not the latter, I think, as a freelancer. If you value your own time as a freelancer, which you really should, if you're treating it like a business it is.
Definitely.
So you had this network to rely on, right, in San Francisco already for both sides of the market. What was that outreach like, let's say on the freelancer side first? Or were you focusing on one side of the marketplace or the other? Or were you trying to build both at the same time? Was there a strategy there to bootstrap your marketplace, which is hard? It's a two-sided marketplace. That's like the classic, like Silicon Valley two-sided marketplace problem, right, that you guys were facing.
Yeah. Yeah, we were fortunate that we grew the developer side consistently with low effort by just having something that they wanted. Mm. So we never really had to super actively try to recruit developers. We were, for the life of Moonlight, consistently trying to figure out the best way to get companies to work with developers and how to monetize that interaction in the most efficient way possible. And so the developer side was pretty self-fulfilling. The line just continued growing. And a lot of that, I think, was because developers wanted remote work.
How did you get in front of them? Like, were there certain communities you were posting in order to just pitch them in the first place, even if the sell was ultimately pretty easy?
It's hard to attribute most people to like one particular site. Mm-hmm. I think that you can think of the traditional marketing idea of it takes like 7 touches for someone to like remember who you are. So we were just always talking openly about what we were working on with Moonlight. We were never very secretive. We were also, you know, living the lifestyle ourselves and writing about that on our blog. we would just take every opportunity that became available. So that summer we did Y Combinator's startup school, and we had an opportunity to get interviewed for office hours that were part of the lecture series. So we got to sit on stage with Sam Altman and, you know, talk about Moonlight. And that was, you know, a great way to get in front of a bunch of people. And then we would just talk about it online. Twitter was a great place. We had Hacker News comments ended up always driving a ton of traffic. And it wasn't like we were intentionally thinking of it as, you know, going out and like building inbound channels or something. It was really just talking about what we were working on, and people thought it was good. And I think that's really a good sign in a business, is you don't want to necessarily say build it and they will come. And I think that's advice that people have heard a bunch over and over again. But in all of these different communities, you always see people that are posting saying, all right, I just finished building this masterpiece of a product. Now, how do I get people to use it?
Yeah.
And that's definitely not the right way to approach building a company. We started Moonlight as a Squarespace landing page. You know, two technical founders who were capable of over-engineering a product. And we started with a no-code prototype. And we just started talking with people and understanding what they wanted and, you know, getting them on the site and getting people on our mailing list long before we had a whole software product. And I think that's really important advice for anybody trying to get into an indie business, is there's nothing stopping you from getting a landing page up today and talking about it openly and doing a product hunt launch and tweeting about it and getting people on that mailing list before you've built anything. And if you can get people to sign up, you are in a good spot. But if you can't get people to sign up for your Squarespace mailing list, building out the product, like, you can't get them to sign up for the product anyways. So you've got top of the funnel issues you need to resolve before you start to build it.
It's definitely a recurring issue that comes up at Indie Worldwide, and also like a recurring solution is people keep trying to throw things at the wall. They just don't stick. Eventually something switches. Like, they focus on the marketing first, they focus on the customers first, and then building later, and suddenly it works.
Yeah, and that's what I think YC would call a solution in search of a problem.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what you want to do, right? Like, the classic sign that you're not, or that you have a solution in search of a problem, is if you build some software and then you say, actually, we think we just found this magical new industry where it's going to take off, you know, call centers or something like that, or restaurants. But I really think that it's important to stick to that initial problem that you discovered, that you empathize with personally, and work from that position and make the solution to that problem rather than just some random product that you're then going to go show to people.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty understandable mistake to make. Like, we're makers, we want to make things. We get hyper-focused on the making and then forget that a business is not just what you build, it's also how you distribute it and who's buying it in the first place. So I understand like where it's coming from. It's a trap I've fallen into myself. And I think that the only way through is just to keep getting better, you know, keep working on new ideas and force yourself to figure out who your customer is before you start building their solution.
And just launching constantly is good, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to make it seem like I'm discouraging people from experimenting and launching ideas. Like, I think the best way to learn is to just do it. And the faster you can get through that cycle of coming up with an idea and launching more often, the more you'll learn. It's a great experience. But I don't think people should necessarily set that expectation ahead of time of, like, this is going to be my $1 million idea, unless they really are going to take it seriously from the customer perspective. Because the nature of software is that it's $0 marginal costs functionally. Like, you can add customers for free. And so the reason people would buy is because they really want it. So you need to make sure you're building that thing that people want. Otherwise, it's more of just like a project or a hobby than a true business.
What was it like on the company side, like getting companies onto Moonlight and buying into the product?
Yeah.
And also, what was the business model? What was the business model as well? How were you charging the companies?
We experimented with a few different pricing models. And I think that was a place where we never really hit the perfect formula for growth. Mm-hmm. We originally were a pure contractor marketplace where we required you to send payments through the app. We added processing fee on top, which was, you know, transparently disclosed to both sides. And then that was how we made money. But we saw that there were problems with disintermediation. So people would work together and then move off platform. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to enforce that. Then we started to see a bunch of people converting to full time and seeing that that was a way companies were used to paying for hires, that their budget for contractors was low, but that their budget for success fees mm-hmm. on full-time hires was tens of thousands of dollars per hire. And so we experimented with that a little bit. And what really got us to good growth was focusing on a subscription-based model where companies paid for access. And that, you know, rocketed us from zero to $10,000 in monthly recurring revenue fairly quickly. But the difficulty there is if you have a month-to-month subscription, it's harder to get people to stick around long-term. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of like a dating site where if your product is too good, then people mm-hmm. stop paying you and leave. And so I believe the way that they're operating the site today is a small, like a token subscription amount with a success fee on top. And I think that is good. But that's, you know, another thing I hear founders constantly say is, oh, we need to build a marketplace for this. But it's, you know, marketplaces are a very specific business model. There's a lot of different business models you can use to connect two parties. If you have, you know, a success fee, you can do that. There's income share agreements where, you know, the people on the site looking for work will pay you. There's platforms where you sell a tool to the people looking for work. And so I would just say generally keep an open mind on monetization, and that at the heart, most businesses come down to a cost of acquisition and a lifetime value. Like everything from, you know, subscription smoothies to hiring businesses. And the more money people spend, mm-hmm. the more money you can spend acquiring them. And so it's really a competitive advantage to have a higher price point because you can spend more money acquiring people. I know that there's, you know, one school of thought, which would be, you know, we're going to try to make it as low as possible so that we, you know, are competitive. Mm-hmm. But it's really a competitive advantage to be able to have higher margins, because if your companies on your site are paying $10,000 per year in subscription, you can spend up to $10,000 getting that customer. And that makes it so much easier to grow. And that, you know, creates that feedback loop, the positive feedback loop that makes it easier to grow. So I would generally say that, you know, pricing is just so key to so many different parts of the business.
That makes sense. So when it came to getting those companies on board, was it just pumping your network, or were you spending $10,000 a year in order to acquire each customer?
We never really had a strategic ad play. Mm-hmm. We did a little bit of retargeting after someone visited, but we did a lot of different things. We ended up using our algorithm for matching developers to jobs for sales. Mm-hmm. So we could scan a company's website, see that they were using Ruby on Rails and React and like Sentry.io for error tracking, mm-hmm. and then plug that into the algorithm and find developers that were a really good fit. So we would use that for cold outreach for sales. We were so good at being able to customize the developers for emails that we were sending out to hiring managers cold, that we had something like, I think it was like a 25% response rate on cold emails. Wow. When you're typically seeing single-digit percentages. We did a long-tail SEO strategy. So if you Google developers in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Cleveland, or if you Google developers that know Ruby on Rails, or even more specific things like developers that know a very specific Kubernetes framework, we had landing pages for that. And we were, you know, we had opportunities to make even more landing pages. I think Zapier.com is the leader in kind of that long tail SEO strategy. If you take any two business tools and Google them together, Squarespace and AdRoll, or mm-hmm. Salesforce and, you know, Shopify, anything like that, they have a landing page that typically will cover that. And it's just a really good way to, instead of trying to compete for the top search terms like hiring, yeah. or hiring software engineers, you're instead competing for the long tail searches, which appear less frequently, but in aggregate create a lot of traffic. And so if you know, can help someone find that software engineer who knows Ruby on Rails in Tulsa, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. then if you have a landing page for that, you're going to rank really high. And that was a really successful way for Moonlight to grow. Also, referral programs, just generally developers talking about Moonlight and having a positive opinion of it helped us grow a lot. And they would often refer companies and hiring managers that they knew to the site. And we saw a lot of people moving between sides of the marketplace. We had startups that would shut down and the people would switch from hiring managers to being job seekers on the site. We had the exact opposite thing happen also, where, you know, leading developers on the site would then go found a startup, raise some money, and come back and hire on it. So it was a lot of different strategies. And I think the biggest way we engaged people was just through a weekly newsletter. Just keeping in contact with that audience and keeping them engaged was so important because it kept us front of mind so that when people were ready to hire or look for a job, you know, they thought of Moonlight.
Can you talk a bit about the how you did your cold email automation? Because I think a lot of people would be interested in also having 25% conversion on their cold emails.
There's a mix of art and science. The team at persistiq.com puts out some really good content. But I would recommend that people who are trying that focus on depth first rather than breadth, meaning you want to write fewer emails that are really good rather than a lot of emails that are really bad. And kind of the key to a good email, besides a lot of, you know, copywriting and subject line optimization, things like that, is relevance and personalization. So there's a big difference between, hey, are you hiring? And, hey, I saw that you're hiring. And then, you know, being more specific of like, hey, I saw you're hiring for a Ruby on Rails developer in Cleveland. Here are three actively looking for work. So the closer you can get to solving their problem, the more, you know, results you'll have. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, keeping it ultra personalized and ultra relevant to their needs is important. Because like what doesn't work is like, oh, I'm going to go buy 10,000 emails and, you know, send 10,000 messages saying, hey, are you hiring? Mm-hmm. And hope that three or four of them are. Like that doesn't work. That, you know, causes problems. But, you know, making it manual first is the most important thing.
In order to figure out what works to even to begin with, what you can automate later.
Yeah. I mean, if you are manually sending cold outreach emails, you go find someone on LinkedIn and you send them a message, and then you compare that to kind of how, like, the cold outreach emails you get in your inbox. I mean, like, having been someone who was hiring at companies, I get so many emails selling me all kinds of stuff that I don't want from agencies and, you know, software startups and all this different stuff. And just like look at those emails and compare it, like study them, because you can learn more from a bad email in some ways than you can learn from a good one. Like, why is it annoying? Why did it end up in your spam box? Mm-hmm. Like, why does it seem out of touch? And just try to keep it natural and don't send bad emails and you won't have problems.
Yeah, at the beginning too, like, it's fine to do so many things manually because any single sale is a meaningful like percent change in your revenue or your customer base.
Yeah.
When you go from one to two, you just grow 100% potentially.
Exactly.
Potentially a day. It's worth it to do it right and figure out what you're doing. Seems like your secret sauce was that scraping tool that's able to find those listings and then key into your existing algorithm in order to make that match. That seemed like a really powerful advantage you guys had.
Our philosophy was never like full automation of anything. It was really building power user tools. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like we had some magic system that, like, you know, just automatically sent emails. Like, we didn't have that. We instead just built tools so that we could look at someone's website and better understand what was happening under the hood with hiring and things like that. And so that is a philosophy I think can be helpful, is don't try to strive for full automation as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Try to build power user tools. And that applies to sales. Like, you know, write your own little scripts to look for keywords in someone's LinkedIn or something, or, you know, a Chrome extension you could use for prospecting or something like that, instead of like trying to fully automate it. Because if you fully automate things before you get it right, then it won't work. And that's kind of like the unfortunate reality of software, is that it tends to be fairly binary in its outcome. Like, it either works or it doesn't. And if you automate something that's not working, it still won't work. No matter how many, you know, computers you throw at it or how much data it collects, if it's not working, it's unlikely to just randomly start working one day.
Makes sense. I'm trying to follow a very similar philosophy with a new product I'm building for Worldwide. It's like an artisanal matching group where we introduce people algorithmically, but it's super supervised. Like, the computer gives me options, I approve them, and every step of the way, it's like, let me do this manually first, figure out how it should work, and then write the script that that semi-automates it. And
yeah, that's great. And scaling problems are the best problems to
have. Yeah, exactly. It's like, as soon as it gets, it's too many for me to do in a couple hours, then I start to automate it. But never without having done it manually first. And even now, it's like, it's automated, but it's not automated. Every single script that I'm like running manually and checking the results and making sure that they're people actually want to introduce to each other is basically the core problem. And I think that's why people have been really satisfied so far, is because there's a human in the loop, extremely in the loop.
Yeah. And you're making sure that you're solving the problem, right? Mm. Like, that's a great generalizable lesson, is your job isn't actually to send emails matching people. Right. Like, your job is to get people talking with each other and on the phone. And generating the matches, if you don't generate them well, or if you don't send emails that people open, or if they get marked as spam, or if they are just a really low quality, you have not actually made progress towards your goal of getting people to talk with each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the first version, like Moonlight being a Squarespace page, was just like a type form. That was the that was it. And then everything else is just like a spreadsheet in my Gmail. I didn't even know how to use a mail merge, so I just sent the emails for like 50 people.
That's great. Yeah. And then at some point you'll be like, there has to be a better way to do this. Mm-hmm. And then you'll discover mail merge or whatever is. But prematurely trying to find all that stuff.
But I was already past the like limits for mail merge. Then I found Postmark and just kind of went from there.
Definitely.
How did you keep, so you mentioned using the newsletter to keep the community engaged. Were there other things you were doing to make it feel less like a hiring platform and more like a community of developers?
We were working on a few different things. We had a Slack channel. Mm-hmm. We wrote a really deep integration with Slack where we were listening to webhooks from all the channels, so we could also show the Slack channels on the website. Mm-hmm. So we could see who sent, you know, what messages and analyze it. And we were working on, you know, continuing to make that more and more powerful. We also would use that Slack integration to send job matches via Slackbot, which was really great. Building that tooling integration with Slack worked because it was what developers were already using. It wasn't like we came out one day and said, today we're just going to build an integration that takes a long time for some reason with this. Instead, it was that we looked at what all of our users had in common, and all of them were in Slack almost all of the day. They all had the app installed on their computers and they were using it often. And so that's why we kind of made the decision to build on top of Slack rather than try to build some extensive in-app community ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good lesson, is just meet your users where they are. If your users are hanging out in Discord, you should probably go on Discord. Yeah. If your users are couriers who are constantly on their phones, maybe an SMS-based solution is better. So just think about, you know, where users are, and it's really impactful there. But then, you know, kind of going to deeper on that, the newsletter was also personalized for each person. So we would say, you know, oh, you are a Rails developer looking for contract work. Here are some Rails jobs that are contract-based. We also did a good job of capturing intent on both sides of the marketplace. So if you were a company, you wanted to hire, so we would capture that intent by saying, post a job. But on the developer side, we originally just had it be like where you had to apply to jobs. And if there was not a job that you liked, then you would just fall off the funnel and not continue engaging. And so we added a way to instead capture that intent right away and say, I am looking for a Ruby on Rails full-time job or something like that. And we would capture that intent and then kind of ramp up how much and what we were sending to you, so that you were getting the most relevant things. And I think that's like, that's the kind of thing where naively you would think like, oh, I'm just going to send a ton of notifications to everybody and eventually someone will get hired. Mm-hmm. But kind of being respectful of boundaries of people is important for retaining folks, because it's one click to unsubscribe in almost all cases. And at that point you have lost them. And so don't growth hack your way to being annoying. Mm-hmm. Like, the best way to growth hack is to build something that people want, and kind of capturing that intent is really important. And I think the other thing that was a really big realization for us was just doing funnel analysis on both sides and seeing where the process was slow, where there were too many steps, and trying to say, what would this look like if we had half as many steps to some primary action, like looking for a job, and really trying to optimize on both sides there. Because you can optimize step to step in a funnel, but if you can make that funnel shorter, you're just going to have exponentially better results.
Were there specific tools you were using to track conversions through your funnel, or is it just kind of going through pretending to be a user and simulating that experience?
I mean, just running through and using the product is so, so, so important. Mm-hmm. If you're using your own product, you're going to just make it smoother, fix spelling errors, say this definitely doesn't have to work like this and address it. And we at our all hands, by the time we were kind of scaling, would show a fullstory.com video of some user with some problem in the app. So if we launched a feature of like posting a job in a new way, mm-hmm. we would show a video of a couple of users actually going through and posting a job. And you kind of have this ideal vision in your head when you build something of, oh yeah, it definitely makes sense. You just click a couple of buttons, fill out this form exactly this way, mm-hmm. and then submit, and you're good. But then you watch real users use it, and you'll see them struggle or pause, or you'll realize that you're asking them for information they haven't thought about, and that really slows them down. So that was one way. It was just really being qualitative about it. On the quantitative side, we were huge users of Metabase. Really love Metabase, which is an open source, self-hosted business analytics tool. You can also run it locally on your computer, but we set that up and used it to constantly be running queries of the data, running funnels, running analysis of like weekly active users, things like that. And part of that was we also built like audit logging into our system from the beginning. So we could see number of people that read a particular profile or something like that. And just collecting that data made it so much easier to do machine learning, like collaborative filtering algorithms and things like that. And it also made it much easier to understand user actions because we didn't have to rely on like a third-party tool like a Mixpanel as the source of truth. Instead, we could just rely on our database as the source of truth.
So can you tell me a bit about the ultimately selling the company, what led to that, and like what that whole process is like?
Yeah. What can we say about that? So the company is pullrequest.com. They run a developer marketplace that helps larger companies and smaller companies review their code. Mm-hmm. So they have this network of reviewers that are working on their platform and, get notifications of, someone has posted some Ruby code in GitHub. Can you go review it for them? And it was a really important part of like code quality initiatives in different companies, but it was also being used by a lot of Moonlight customers to review the code quality of contractors. And so we saw a partnership opportunity there. And there was also kind of a desire from some pull request customers who would see feedback of, this isn't the right way to do it. Here's how you probably should go about it to make it more efficient or do best practices. And they would want to be able to say, okay, well, can you just fix it? Mm-hmm. And they didn't really have that capability at that time. So that was kind of where Moonlight and Pull Request really had this potential for like a symbiotic relationship of us helping them grow their reviewer network, their reviewers being able to actually start writing code to help customers. And then when those customers got code written to be able to get it reviewed. Mm-hmm. And so we got an introduction to their company through one of our investors and ended up having opportunity to get finalized. And we closed the deal a few weeks before COVID-19 hit. So the timing was fairly fortunate. And they're continuing to operate the site, and it's live at moonlightwork.com.
So did you guys reach out to them with the idea, like, let's get acquired by Pull Request, or did it kind of turn into that after talks started?
It was a little more serendipitous.
So you were just kind of looking for a straight partnership to begin with. Like, we'll trade users, we'll trade capabilities, but not necessarily, like, let's become the same company.
It kind of became clear that we had kind of a unified labor force mm-hmm. underneath. And that there were different ways to utilize it. Like what we did with Moonlight, it was extremely general. If you wanted, we had people like, I think one user hired someone to teach her to code. She is now like a venture funded startup based on the code she wrote. We had people hiring to do open source work. We had people hiring for full-time teams. And so it was kind of every different way you could use Moonlight. It was, you could use it. But what pull requested that was so amazing is it was very focused. It was, we use software developers to review code, and it's very clear, like when you sign up for the reviewer network, like what you're signing up for, how it works, and how companies interact with that network is very straightforward. And so I think that there's, you know, really interesting opportunities to continue to kind of innovate on what is this kind of broader group of people that are looking for short-term flexible contract work, you know, focusing on that problem and offering it to them in different ways, which could be code review, but it could also be writing code. It could, and then in the future, there could even be additional, you know, levels that are built on top of there. But if you're just looking at it from the problem side of these developers, like their problem is that they want flexible income, and there's a variety of different ways that they could get that. And I think that's kind of why that partnership really made sense.
It sounds like the deal went through pretty quickly too. Like I've read that M&A processes can be really drawn out and painful, but maybe by virtue of both being startups, it went a little smoother.
Yeah, we weren't a very big company either. So it wasn't like we were, like when I was at OpenDNS, that was a huge deal and like, you know, hundreds of people involved just in terms of like getting hired. For Moonlight, it was like very much a small deal. And I think that's part of the nice thing about having a smaller company is you have a little bit more optionality.
To go a little bit back again to when you decided to raise money for Moonlight, when did you decide, what was the motivation to raise money after having bootstrapped to a certain point?
Yeah. We put our pitch deck online a couple of weeks ago. It's on tinker.fyi. So if you go down to the footer and click columns, you should see a link to it. So you can see our pitch there. And Moonlight at the beginning was a very functional, like straightforward business, kind of taking on recruiting agencies. And as we worked on it longer and longer, we started to see this opportunity for broader work changes. We have the slide in the pitch deck that's kind of like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but for like remote developers. And kind of at the bottom of it is just jobs and getting paid. But we kind of saw that there was this additional set of needs that we were having people within the network looking to have addressed that were stability and community, ongoing education. And I still strongly believe that there's going to be a lot of interesting companies that look at that pyramid of remote workers and say, you know, as a work from home workforce, you're no longer going to have as much mentorship in the office. You're no longer going to have as much community from work. You're no longer going to have such easy access to going from junior to senior. So, and it's also going to be harder to prove your abilities to. And so we think there's a lot of opportunities around certifications and things like that to create trust points between disconnected people that could potentially work together. And so that was kind of what we raised money on for Moonlight, was this idea of going from hiring to additional ways to service remote developers. And we were, you know, working on a variety of ways to do that. But I think that's still like a long journey that a lot of different people are going to be involved in.
Did you, what were you hoping to get by raising money? Like, was there the grandest vision of Moonlight, I guess, that you were trying to get to?
We were trying to help the world work together and really wanted to make it easier for people to have access to high quality remote work, even if they weren't in Silicon Valley. And so that's hard, right? Like today, in a COVID world, it seems a little bit more straightforward. But I think the timing was a little hard for us to try to convince companies because, you know, a lot of them were like, we will never, ever, ever be remote. I mean, this was around the time when, you know, Reddit was firing people who refused to move to their office. Now Reddit is, you know, trying to get people to be remote. And so we wanted to start building some of that tooling on top, right? Because we had distribution and engaged audience, and we wanted to be able to start addressing their needs post-hire, which were problems, right? Like, this wasn't necessarily like a hypothetical thing, but you know, we would have people we would work with who were freelancing for decades because they couldn't get a stable job, and they didn't have, you know, the ability to get healthcare easily, and they were learning or working in some esoteric programming language that was no longer popular, and they didn't really have access to resources to kind of learn what was happening in the current time. And, you know, as we traveled, we would constantly be holding these meetups for Moonlight. We would host meetups in Mexico City and Barcelona and all around, and see that among remote workers, there was also just like a need for more community. I mean, you said that you were hosting meetups in San Francisco. I was hosting meetups in San Francisco. Like, in San Francisco, if you want to go to a JavaScript meetup or a Kubernetes meetup or a Python meetup during, you know, non-COVID times, like, they're all available there. But if you are a really fantastic Kubernetes expert based in Chile or something, it's way harder to build a community and continue your professional growth, but also to receive mentorship or provide mentorship. And so I think that we're going to see a decoupling in the future of jobs and some of these things that have traditionally been provided by jobs, such as community, ongoing education, things like that. I mean, if you look back at the industrial age, the expectation was that you would get hired for a job and then they would train you to do the job. Like, if you were going into a factory, they would hire you and then you would go into the factory and they would train you to operate the equipment. But today's world is way more egalitarian in the sense that if you want to get a software job, you have to prove that you already know the software to get the job. And there's less of a world where you are going to get hired and then taught on the job things you need to know. And so I think that that trend is going to just continue, and that there's going to be more and more need for people to learn. And it's not just going to affect people that are new to the industry, but it's going to affect people that were really good PHP developers and now are having trouble finding PHP jobs in a world where people are moving on to different languages.
I agree, absolutely. It seems like we're kind of working on a legacy system where we depend on the job to provide, almost be like a parent to us, where they provide so many things. And most jobs just don't do that. They don't take care of your health or like your retirement in the future. They'll try to take care of your friends, but then you lose those friends if you ever leave the job. Seems like a very fragile, the default setup to me seems very fragile and unsustainable. Whereas I see the trend more and more of, especially now that people are going remote and kind of treating their jobs in a more transactional way to begin with, and doing, they're kind of becoming almost freelancers, whether they like it or not. This like transition, I think, is speeding up a bit, the way you've laid it out, of people wanting even their like professional network to be separate from their work network, you know, and their friends to be separate and their healthcare to be separately taken care of. And I think it's going to be a kind of a painful transition because a lot of people are depending on their jobs right now for that. But on the other side of it, once you have all these things separate, you are in a more secure place in a way, because if one of these systems breaks now, it doesn't break all the other systems, where the current setup is you lose your job, okay, all these things are effed up at the same time and I have to fix all of them, versus let me just get a new job, but my healthcare is still taken care of, I still have friends, like I still have these meetups I'm going to, I still have professional connections. So,
and we're even seeing people changing where they're living just based on the services given by the government. Like New York is having a lot of finance people moving to Florida because it's lower taxation and they no longer are strongly tied to New York. I mean, I ran the numbers and like my paycheck would have increased 10% without any change in the gross if I had just moved a couple of states over from New York just because of taxation rules. Not that I think that that is, you know, the end all be all, but that's just, it would change based on where I live. Non-competes are going to become increasingly contentious. If an Amazon worker moves to California and works remotely from there, it changes the legal relationship potentially. I'm not saying it definitely does, but in California, non-competes are unenforceable. But there are some large tech companies like Amazon that are notorious for severely limiting people's options after they leave Amazon due to non-compete clauses. And so we're seeing people cherry picking where they're living because of the legal environment like that too. And I think, you know, healthcare and things like that have the potential to also factor into that. So A lot of things happening.
I didn't even think about
really good
that
book
move.
Called The Sovereign Individual.
What's
that
it
talks
called?
About that.
The Sovereign Individual. I'm gonna check that out. Sounds right up my alley. That would be such a baller move. If you were trying to, like, say you're at Amazon, you want to start a startup, so you move to California, work remote for long enough in order to be under California employment laws, and then cut ties like that. I haven't seen that happen yet. I would.
I'm not saying that that would work.
Right.
I'm
we
just
are not
talking
lawyers.
About this. Like,
you're not suggesting do that.
And it.
I would like to see
and it doesn't
somebody pull it off.
Stop though. Them. And it doesn't stop them from suing you either.
No.
Like, just because it's.
This is America.
You know,
we can sue.
They
can
still pursue it.
We can sue for whatever we want.
But employment lawyers constantly tell me that non-competes get enforced way more often than you would think they do, because they're often just, like, very confidential. That, you know, someone will leave a company and go to a new one, and then both the person and the company will receive a letter in the mail saying, you know, I'm not sure if you knew this, but one of the divisions at our company is very slightly adjacent to the new company you went to, so you can't work there because of the non-compete. And then people just are very limited for, you know, the period of the non-compete, typically a year.
So. Yeah, that turns my stomach, that strategy. It's just so scummy. If the employee wasn't in that division and they don't have that secret knowledge, it's just legal bullshit.
They'll say, even just like, if you know people and you have their phone number in your cell phone, that those could be trade secrets. There's a lot going on. I think that we're going to see this start to crop up more prominently in the future. Like, right now, big companies will pay to defend executives that they poach. Mm. So when, you know, Airbnb poaches someone from, like, an AWS or something, they will fight publicly. But, you know, a lot of these fights are very private and end up getting settled in, like, mandatory arbitration, which is also a very difficult and controlled process that favors the companies.
Have you had to go through a mandatory arbitration before for any of your companies?
No, never, fortunately. Have you?
No. I've only seen it on, like, Silicon Valley.
But it exists.
Yeah. So if you were starting a new company, would you go straight to raising money now, or would you try to bootstrap it again? Would you do some kind of hybrid?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing is falling in love with the problem, not the solution. Like, if the danger is saying, I have a really great thing, I'm going to start a company and sell it, that's not a good reason to go start the company. But as soon as you have, like, a huge need from people who, like, want to pay you to solve something, I think that is more of what a company is, and that's where you can start to take it seriously. Between bootstrapping and raising money, we kind of did both. With bootstrapping, you maintain optionality and can really control the full outcome. You know, your boss is mostly your customers rather than external investors. But, you know, the problem is that the nature of software is that it's expensive to build and cheap to operate. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense in a lot of cases to take VC if your market size is there. So if you're just trying to build a business that sustains you and you're not trying to, you know, IPO in 10 years, then it probably doesn't make sense to take venture capital money. But kind of the nature of software is that you can take on these really ambitious problems due to the way software distribution works. And as long as you're going after a hard problem and you want to make something ambitious, I think that there are advantages to raising money because you then get more resources to focus on that initial problem. But, you know, it's a very complex calculus. I could argue either side, and I think it really varies circumstance by circumstance. But, like, a great example is, and if you want to build out a company and have, like, 30-something engineers, with 34 engineers, WhatsApp sold for $19 billion and was supporting 450 million active users. And so the kind of the power of software is that you have this, like, huge upfront cost to make something work, but it's just so inexpensive to operate. And so it really depends on kind of what you want out of your business, whether you want to grow it, whether you want to be spending your time coding or managing other people, whether you are willing to, you know, have the company die trying to pursue growth, or whether you would be happy with something that does revenue comparable to an agency and you don't necessarily want to go double or nothing with the company.
Did you, when you started Moonlight, did you have raising money in the back of your mind, or did it eventually like bubble its way up?
We had it in the back of our minds, but we didn't really have a focus saying, like, this is our $1 billion opportunity. And that's such an important part of raising venture capital, is market sizing. Like, if you can't get your business to 100 million in ARR or a billion in ARR, if you get 100% of the market, then it's not necessarily going to be a good fit for VC. There are some other models like earnest capital and indie VC, which definitely change that. And I think those really make a lot of sense. But I think the bar in some ways is higher for some of these bootstrapper funds because they are really revenue based. Mm-hmm. And the main reason I think that they want to be investing in companies is to help you where your only problem restricting growth is capital, so that you can go out, get companies and build the features they want. But you kind of need to already be at in the range of like $5,000 to $10,000 a month of recurring revenue to have a revenue driven fund invest. Mm. So there's still that cold start problem. So I think general advice to entrepreneurs is if you can just focus on getting your software company to $5,000 to $10,000 per month in monthly recurring revenue, you have optionality. You'll be harder to ignore by venture capitalists if that's the path you want to go down. You will have traditional, loans potentially even become available. There's a lot of different like loan-based products coming online for software startups. Then there's revenue-based funding like earnest capital that could be a good fit. But you know, for getting from zero to $5,000 or $10,000 in monthly recurring revenue is hard. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to fundraise on nothing yet, it's way harder.
Coming out of like Staffjoy into Moonlight, what were your takeaways from that first swing and that you applied to Moonlight? What were some of the differences there?
So much. Anything specific you like want to talk about, or
what came to your mind first?
A lot of it, I think, is about sticking to your initial insight. So Staffjoy's kind of initial insight was that there were these hyperscaling contractor workforces and that we could help these businesses that went from 100 to 300 couriers within a couple of weeks manage those workers. And over time, we tried building out more of like a call center product, and then we kind of built out like a restaurant product. And we strayed further and further from that initial insight, when I think that initial insight was just so important. And so a lot of businesses will start and kind of try to boil the ocean, mm-hmm. and think, you know, we must be generalizable. You know, we can't make this feature because it'll only apply to a small subset of our customers. But it's a balance, right? Like, there's no general advice here that is going to hold universally true. But as a general rule, you want to make a product that fewer people absolutely love rather than one that a lot of people kind of semi-like. And I think that's a much bigger key to success.
How do you tell the difference between straying from your original idea and pivoting to a new idea?
I think it's staying in love with the problem rather than the solution. So if you are addressing the same problem and you say, I'll just make up an example. People, let's say you're trying to help people who follow a paleo diet and can't get food at home. If you are originally selling them a milkshake product and then you realize, no, like, we don't want to sell them milkshakes, they actually just want frozen food, I don't think that's a pivot. I think that that's staying true to the problem rather than the solution. I think a pivot is if you take a different group of people and a different problem. As long as you're staying true to that problem, I think you're in a good space. I think a pivot would be if you say, oh, these people were selling milkshakes to people who are on a paleo diet. But actually, it turns out people who are on a medically restricted diet for some reason also really like these milkshakes. Let's maybe ditch the paleo people and just go focus on the medically restricted diet. I think I would consider that more of a pivot because you're completely switching the problem that you're focusing on. And that means you're dealing with a different set of users, with different needs, with different purchasing habits. And you lose all of those insights you had about the merits of products in the paleo area. And you have to start over from scratch, even though kind of the product stays the same.
Looking back now at Staffjoy, can you like retrospectively identify a moment where you had strayed too far? Maybe even though you didn't realize it at the time?
We, a lot of businesses reach this point where they have glimmers of product market fit, and then it turns out that they really didn't have it and they kind of need to go back to the drawing board. And I've been at companies that were like that as an employee, and it's a hard thing to deal with. And I think we had that moment at Staffjoy when we were like, oh, like we're starting to sell this. Like people kind of want what we're building. And so we hired a full-time salesperson who was great, but people didn't want the product, it turned out. And we kind of felt like we had success a few weeks ago. We should be able to continue to figure it out. And so we kind of kept on a salesperson for a product nobody wanted to buy and just started scrambling quickly and started working on a restaurant version of the product instead. And I think that was a point where we should have made hard decisions and said, we have a great salesperson who's selling something nobody wants. Maybe it's our fault with the product and we should focus more on the product and dig in deeper with the customers and find out more about what they want. And I think that was definitely like a point where things started to go off the rails.
Is there, knowing what you know now, is there a way that you can measure whether you actually have a product people want or if it's just like a false signal?
I mean, Superhuman has an interesting test, which I forget the specifics of it, but it's something about measuring how unhappy would you be if this product went away. That's one way to go about it. I think the other thing is churn. Like, as an early business, churn is just the canary in the gold mine. I've been at businesses with negative churn, where the customers spend more and more and more money every year, and I've been at businesses with 90% plus churn. And at both of those businesses, customers are happy when they sign up, but it's really whether they stick around that is just so impactful. That's why Snowflake's IPO is just blowing up. It's because their churn numbers are, I believe, negative and just looking really good. And so if you look at your business and customers are not sticking around, that should be the first sign that something is very wrong. In fact, you should be having your customers want to give you more and more money over time. How would they give you more money? If you look at something like Google Apps, which is you have per seat memberships and they just add more and more seats over time. That's an example of a customer spending more money over time, where they start off paying $10 a month and by the end are spending like 60 a month or something. So that's what I would really pay attention to. And then also just hopping on the phone and making sure you're solving that customer's problems. Especially in the early days when you don't have many customers, just keeping a dialogue and making sure that, you know, if their problem is I'm trying to hire, like, are you actually getting them hires? Like, they don't care about your product. They don't care whether it's a web dashboard or a mobile app. They don't care about, you know, your new email campaign. At the end of the day, they just want their problem solved. And it doesn't matter whether it's a tech product or a mail order, you know, subscription service or something. Your job is to solve that problem. And as long as you're solving that problem, you are on a path that should be good, hopefully.